the Saturday Light Brigade, and I'm so happy that we have two of my favorite people here with us today. And I just learned something I think that will astound you too. See if you can identify the song. Just listen to it for a moment. Recognize it, right? Smile, though your heart is aching, breaking, aching, something. Smile, because you have Dan Kamen.
That's here. Really good, Larry. Next.
Next. Dan came in. Good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
It's nice to have you here. Now tell me, you just informed me of... Oh, and Tom Roberts. Let's say hi to Tom.
Hi, Larry.
Not like your chopped liver over there. Tom's in the corner.
Stuck in the corner. I was bad. Don't talk to me.
Yes, we put Tom in the corner with a piano.
Don't shoot the piano player.
No, don't. So this song is older than I ever would have thought.
It's older, and almost everybody knows this song because it's been sung by Michael Jackson and Robert Downey and all kinds of people. Nat King Cole made it famous. But the song was actually written by Charlie Chaplin, and it was written not as a song, but just as part of the soundtrack for his great 1936 movie, Modern Times.
Is that the way it sounded in
that
the
is
movie?
The soundtrack. That's the very end of the movie.
Wow. I had no idea.
And about 20 years later, when they revived the movie, somebody got the idea, that was kind of a nice tune. Let's turn it into a song. So they put lyrics to it, kind of sappy lyrics compared to the music, which is very emotional and moving. But a lot of people like those lyrics, too. Smile when your heart is breaking and all that stuff.
That's great. And what did he call it, Smile, do you know, when he wrote it?
You know, it's a good question. It comes from... It was an odd movie because it's a sound movie with music, but it doesn't have any words in it. Nobody speaks any words, yeah. So there's silent movie subtitles. And at the very end, the last subtitle is he looks at Paulette Goddard. They're sad because they've been fired from their jobs, and he says, and she starts to cry, and he says, "Smile, buck up, we'll get along," and then he makes a little smile with his finger on his lips, and she smiles, and they walk down the road. And as they walk down that road, it was the last, nobody knew it at the time, but it was the last road that the silent character of Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp would ever walk down. That was the end of his cinematic journey.
I didn't know that either. What's the year of that film?
It came out in 1936. And he called it Modern Times, but it was really a silent movie with music. And so it was modern, but it was also saying goodbye to the whole era of silent movies. So when you know that stuff now and you look at the movie, it makes it even more moving than it was for people when they watched it back then. Because, of course, they thought he'd come back again to make them laugh.
You know, I think of that movie, which I've seen maybe half a dozen times, but it's been a while. I think of it as having... could have sworn the jackhammer sounds were in the film, but no, they were in my head, weren't they?
No, they were in the music. He did.
And there are sounds. There are sounds in the film because, like, when the boss speaks to Charlie, he's like, "Get back to work." You know, there is a voice. There's the disembodied voice of the automatic salesman, which is a record playing.
Okay.
When they demonstrate the feeding machine. And so there are sounds and there are occasional voices. And that is the film where Chaplin actually broke his silence as he sang a nonsensical version of Tintina.
You know, the movie isn't very, you can look at it in different levels. On one level, it is a satire of talking movies, because every time you hear a voice in the movies, in the movie, it's coming off a record, or it's on the radio, or it's the boss doing a television, kind of intercom television, which was very sci-fi at the time.
Yeah.
And so Chaplin keeps on reminding us that sound is artificial, but that movement is not. Movement is where the people live, and that's how they communicate in a silent movie. And it was his last gasp as a silent. He didn't want sound movies to come around because it meant the end of his art as he had been practicing it, because he was the king of silent movies. And only he succeeded in making two silent movies in the sound era that were big hits.
Charlie Chaplin, I'm starting to realize, was a genius and a Renaissance man. The manner in which he moved, the manner in which his films were put together, and the depth of what he was able to do. I always sort of took him somewhat superficially, but he was a real perfectionist and a real artist, wasn't he?
Well, you know, most movies, they serve a function for us. We go to see Gravity, we go to see the latest comedy with Ben Stiller or whoever, and, you know, they make us laugh, and fine. You don't expect the same movie to make us laugh 10 years later any more than you want to read a newspaper from 10 years ago. The strange thing about Charlie Chaplin, I mean, the term genius, he made fun of it himself because people started calling him a genius almost from the very start of his movie career. But the strange thing is that he started making movies. This is the 100th anniversary of Charlie Chaplin's film debut, the birth of his character, his famous tramp character. It's his 125th anniversary. So there's two births we're celebrating this year. People are celebrating them all over the world. And the why they're celebrating them is because 100 years later, against anybody's expectation, these movies are still making us laugh. And I can prove it because Tom Roberts proved it. 2 weeks ago, we went to the Hollywood Theater, and Tom showed four Charlie Chaplin movies with scores that he created to accompany them, because, of course, silent movies always had live musicians accompanying them. And he showed the very first movie that Charlie Chaplin played his little tramp in came out on February 7th, 1914. And, you know, it's usually you think of this as a historical curiosity. It's an odd little movie. And the audience was screaming with laughter.
It happened as well. I did it at Washington Jefferson College, I guess, last week. The same thing happened with this film. And I know that Dan and I, this is just as Dan says, this is a movie that you think, okay, it's the first time that you see him. But perhaps what it is what occurs during that film is it's somewhat resonant with us today because he's photobombing. There's basically a camera. There's a movie camera there that is pretending to be filming an auto race. And this odd character sees it and just keeps putting himself in front of that character over and over and over again, in front of that camera. And he just can't stay away from the camera. And people just go bananas over this.
Now, Tom had the great pleasure of being commissioned with support from the Sprout Fund and others to write new scores. Right?
Well, the Sprout Fund commission was that. It's not actually a commission. The Sprout Fund was, that's the series at the Hollywood Theater, which is called Silence Plays.
Oh, okay, to present
various silent films at the Hollywood. The first two films that I scored were via the Pittsburgh Symphony, and then this last one was commissioned by this guy named Dan Kamen. He hasn't paid me a penny yet. He's makes gluten-free pizzas and things like this and expects that this is going to be enough to satisfy me. And, you know, I'm going to be speaking to my lawyers very soon to him about seeing if I can get my my money for this project.
That was a fat-free commission, Tom.
Fat-free commission. Dairy-free. Do you think it's worth this, Larry? Dairy-free pizza. Oy vey.
Well, I think that Dan also watch him in court because he frequently exercises the right to be silent.
Oh!
Somebody once gave me...
Ooh. Ooh.
Somebody once gave me a birthday card because when I started my adult performing career, I was a mime, and I still do mime in my shows.
Yeah.
But it's sneaky, sort of like Charlie Chaplin's a mime. I look at it, you know, in the broadest way. It's just talking with your body language. But somebody gave me a birthday card once that said, if a mime falls in the woods, does anybody care?
You know,
people still care about Charlie Chaplin, that's for sure. And that's why I'm so glad to be part of the show today, because you know what? It was when you see the odd thing about this little movie, where the first movie that Charlie Chaplin made that we're talking about, we're both excited about it because we didn't, neither of us realized that the audience would respond so strongly, because you can't respond. You can't kind of get these films when you see them on like YouTube, on your television. You have to be in an audience, see them on a big screen with live music. And, you know, it was just but what you see in this film, it's a very odd film because they went to a real event. It was like a documentary.
Yeah.
They went to a kid's auto race. And in the film, it's only 7 minutes long, you watch the crowd gradually become aware of Charlie Chaplin cavorting with the fake cameraman. And they start looking away from the kids who are coming down on these hair-raising kind of this hill where they're pushing, sort of like the CMU buggy races, they're pushing the buggies, and they start looking away, and they start watching Charlie, and people start to laugh, especially the children. And it was the children. Charlie Chaplin said, yeah, it was the kids who discovered me. They made me famous. So I'm really glad to be on your show to commemorate, you know, we're both glad to commemorate on such a great show that is focused on the experience of children.
Yeah, and adults as well, because one of the things Charlie Chaplin, you know, he fit a multi-generational audience, right? Just like great music does, because, you know, you watch those films, and one of my favorites, I forget the film, where he's coming home.
1 a.m.
Yeah, after a night of Coca-Colas, he comes
Yes,
home.
He's had Coca-Colas and some phosphates and yes. A lot of root beer. Yeah. Lots of root beer.
Lots and lots of root beer, sans root, and he comes home, and his movement's amazing. And, you know, if you're a kid, it's funny just because somebody's coming home and a little awkward. If you're an adult, you might relate to the genuine efforts to not make a sound as he comes in.
In those days, people thought it was, you know, it was a staple of comedy. Up until very recently, the film Arthur with Dudley Moore,
yeah,
drunk people were funny because they were stupid. They got dumb. But it's not, Charlie Chaplin liked it because it allowed him to be graceful and show what a great acrobat he was. And it wasn't just being drunk that did it. You know, we see the same thing. Somebody gets conked on a head in a cartoon,
yeah,
or another kind of movie. And, you know, it gives you know, a lot of humor, silent physical humor, is about being dumb and being clumsy and falling. And what Tom did was he wrote this amazing score to accompany it that doesn't sound funny, but that makes it sound like the kind of woozy. Could you play a little of that,
yeah,
Tom?
I was going to say.
Tom's
yeah, we got all types of. And before we go into that, I did want to say about comment on the universality of it all. I mean, it's not. This is not something that's just for kids. This is not something that's only for senior citizens. I have been stopped on several occasions by super fine 20-something hot girls, you know, tattoos and the asymmetrical haircuts, and they just say to me, no, this is not going anywhere.
No, it's okay.
Inappropriate just, Larry behavior.
I'm marveling at.
This one woman came up to me with the asymmetrical haircut and the tattoos and scantily clad and just said, I was at your Chaplin event at Bar Marco. It was the most magical thing I've ever seen in my life. And then another beautiful 20-year-old type girl came up to me and said, oh my God, it was life altering. So this is not a historic curiosity. This is not something for old people. It's not for young people. The appeal of this is so broad. And if you have the heart, you can really experience this thing, and it will, as Zoe said, it's life-altering. It's a wonderful thing.
It's amazing that people are mistaking you for Dan Kamen when they come up and talk to you that way.
I know, really. So wait, you wanted me to play. So Dan, you wanted to hear the 1 a.m. thing, huh?
I love your score for 1 a.m. because it just sounds like that state of consciousness where you're sort of fuzzed out and you're so tired, or in his case, so drunk.
If I may talk over this, one of the things that was my inspiration was I was pretty out of it myself on my medication post-surgery, so it did help me get myself into this state of mind. Dan calls this a little nocturne. And this is a wonderful little film. The film we're going to talk about today is something for Dan's show where he really analyzes the motion of Chaplin. And Dan is in a position where most people aren't. He is able to see and explain to you what Chaplin does that creates this ability of why we laugh at it. I'm going to tell you, I've watched these films thousands of times. There's one scene in the pawn shop where I've seen it 1,000 times just to try to find music that fits it, that is not going to compete with it, and I still find it funny every single time I see it. I've seen it 1,000 times. I've watched it for hundreds and hundreds of hours trying to find music that is not going to compete with what he is doing on screen. There's another one. We're talking about these inebriate movies of Chaplin. There's a film called The Rounders, and there are two scores that go with it. Fatty Arbuckle and Chaplin playing drunken gentlemen, and one of them has a great ragtime score, and the other one has this very dainty music. And the one with the ragtime score doesn't make you laugh. You don't laugh at all at it. However, the very dainty music that is completely the opposite of what you see, you fall out of your seat.
The music has that effect. Music really has that effect. It mediates your experience so that you're seeing it through. And when you see it with a live musician on a big screen, you get why these films took over the world.
Dan, something I'm curious about, it just occurred to me.
Why does Tom keep talking about drunkenness?
No, that's the... I
can answer that, but it'll take a while.
I understand that reason, but it is, I don't know what the right noun is for, and maybe it's simply actor who specializes in movement, but is that person kind of like a magician? Or because when I watch somebody, and you're among them, that can control his body or her body so well and do things that seem impossible. And Dan brings out a coin right now and is doing a sleight of hand coin roll over his knuckles. Is it similar to magic in that not so much that we're deceived, but that we're just delighted by, oh my God, how is that possible? I don't know how to explain it because I'm mesmerized by dance, partly because I have not one bit of dance in me, I think, but just at how people do it, you know?
Well, it's such a good observation that you're making, because it is like magic. And, you know, I was at Carnegie Mellon as a student when I saw my first Charlie Chaplin movie. I'd never seen him growing up. And I saw my first film. It was an illegal, pirated Charlie Chaplin film they showed on the campus. And it just knocked me out. And when I was 12... I started doing magic from seeing another movie, a movie about Houdini with Tony Curtis.
Oh, great movie.
Yeah, I love that movie.
It's a fabulous movie. And I was so knocked out by it that at the first opportunity, I started studying, and I became a boy magician. Thinking I would impress girls, you know, that way. And, of course, I later realized that being a magician, you know, was like spraying girl repellent all over my body.
Yeah.
But I saw this Charlie Chaplin movie, and it so knocked me out because I'd never seen anybody who could make me laugh that hard without talking. And I realized when I started to think about it, it's because he thinks like a magician. All his gags are like magic tricks.
So when you're a kid, did you sort of try to break it down and analyze it? And did you come to that conclusion, you know, as a teen? It's like, interesting. Did you start to, because you're capable of doing that when you're a teenager.
Well, you have to learn, to, like just like learning music, you have to be able to do things one little part at a time and analyze them. There's no way to learn a musical instrument without doing that, and there's no way to learn magic. It's very technical. And, you know, in those days, pre-internet days, I would get a book from the library, and there would be seven pages describing a movement of your fingers that takes place in a half a second. And I had to just plow my way through that stuff to find, and then eventually I found mentors who were, in some cases, card sharps and criminals who liked to hang out with magicians, and I got into the craft of magic. Then I saw Charlie Chaplin. I did the same thing. I went to the library to find out what's the technical secrets of why a gag that he made up in 1925 is still funny, you know, 30, 40 years later when I saw it. And I realized that wasn't, nobody wrote about that in the books. So eventually I had to write that book myself to be able to read it. One of the things I realized is gags are structured like magic tricks. And it's one of the things that Tom and I will be doing when we do our program. Tom is debuting, I've been doing a program for years called Funny Bones, the Comedy of Charlie Chaplin. And it isn't me exposing Charlie Chaplin's secrets. It's the audience discovering them for themselves. Because I taught Robert Downey to be Charlie Chaplin for the movie, and people started asking me to give talks, and I went early on. I gave a talk in a library, and half the people sitting there were senior citizens, and across the aisle were children, really young children. And I realized as soon as I opened my mouth, I was going to lose one half of the room or the other. And I had a sudden flash of inspiration that the only way I can survive this is to get them talking to each other. So instead of talking, I showed the movie, and I just gave them a couple of little clues to how they could decode the magic of what Charlie Chaplin is doing. And they all started talking at once. Everybody, once they knew the key, they wanted to unlock the lock. And that's what happens in the program we're doing next week. And the audience will get to see one complete Charlie Chaplin film, which with Tom's brand new score, fresh out of the oven, for The Pawn Shop, a 1916 film that is full of these magical gags. And then we start to talk about it, and there's lots of audience participation. Everybody gets into the act, so it's not me holding, but I will, of course, I can't resist. I will do some magic, I will do some mime, and, you know, because the more you look at these films, the more they unfold their secrets, and they don't get, Tom said he keeps on laughing at certain, I see a new thing every time I see a Charlie Chaplin film, any of them. And I also, you know, learn things from the audience. I do these things because I've stolen a lot of ideas from doing this program that I put into some of my books.
I love the sense of analysis that is part of this, that really trying to understand exactly how Charlie was achieving what he was and breaking it down. Tom, can you play a little bit of the...
What would Charlie Chaplin do?
Yes, actually...
the Church of Charlie Chaplin. I'm a rabbi in the Church of Charlie Chaplin.
Can you sort of describe a scene from the Pawn Shop? I'll give you a couple minutes, maybe a couple scenes, and then kind of work through what you did to accompany it. And as you're thinking, I just want to mention February 21st, that's this Friday at 8, and then the following Sunday, February 23rd at 2, you can enjoy the program that will feature a film and Tom playing and discussion with Dan at the Strand Theater in Zeeland Opal, 119 North Main Street. And it's really, I say this kind of thing every now and then. This is the kind of thing that if you could, you would drive a couple hundred miles to go see. And it's quite fortunate to have it this local because you really... It's the old prophet in your own town kind of thing. We have two world-known people here that are probably the only people in the world that can do what this presentation is bringing. I'll say that. They might, too, but I feel more comfortable saying it. So I hope you'll consider going to it again. It's the 21st, Friday, 8 o'clock, and the 23rd, the following Sunday at 2 o'clock in Zelianopol, which is only about 20 minutes north, 30 minutes north of Pittsburgh. It's easy to get to.
So ideally, when you see a silent film, and Dan will probably remember who said this because I can't remember it. Someone made the comment that a silent film is like being in a dream. Do you remember who said that?
I think you said it, Tom.
Oh, no wonder it sounded so brilliant. Genius! But it is very dreamlike. No, I didn't say it, but I read it in one of these books. But it is very much a dreamlike thing, and it's something, music that would compete with that dream takes you out of it. If you're too aware of the music, if the music has nothing to do with what you're seeing on screen, I've seen things like this. You're not in the dream anymore. If the music is totally incidental and worthless, then you're not in the dream. You need to kind of disappear into that state, that magical state. So what do you want to, Dan, what do you think would be nice? There's a lot of different things. I mean,
play your Charlie theme. Play your Charlie theme.
Well, I'll make the combination between the pawnbroker's theme. Do you want to tell the story a little bit without giving it all away?
It's Charlie is the lowly assistant in a pawn shop, and it begins with the pawnbroker pacing back and forth because, of course, Charlie is late. And then we see Charlie walking without a care in the world into the pawn shop.
Now, the pawnbroker is played by Henry Bergman, and he is he is Orthodox Jewish in this?
He's walking and he's doing very Jewish kind of gestures of shrugging his arms and wringing his hands and, you know, oh my God,
what's he doing? Where is he? He's not here. So something Eastern European sounding. So my focus was, well, this is obviously kind of Eastern European, so what are the things that we're going to use? Klezmer kind of things, horas, but then there's also the classical music of Eastern Europe. There's the Polonaise, there's the Mazurka, there is, I can't think of anything else right now, but like this is, so here is the pawnbroker's theme. There's this little motion, and it was actually, I heard a recording of Abe Schwartz and the Yiddish Orchestra on a Green Label Columbia acoustic recording where they just had this kind of odd motion from the fifth to the minor sixth. Unusual is what you more expect to hear from a klezmer thing. And so, but this was unusual. And so I took Chaplin's theme. Charlie's theme takes the same melodic fragment. However, it goes into major. So here's Bergman is very, oh, where is he? Where is he? Charlie's is. Uses exactly the same ending. Psychologically and subconsciously, when you're watching these films, you should have some level of continuity that goes between all of these individuals. Even if you're not consciously aware of it, you should be able to hear these tiny little bits and pieces of melodic fragments that connects and contrasts each of these individuals.
Are they in the same key?
They're in both in G. The pawnbroker is in G minor. Charlie is. And Charlie is. Carefree. And also his own unique little self, which is one of the things that you start to get. And if you've got, we're not going to give it all away because Dan is the guy who pointed this out to me. We don't want to give it all away, but Charlie's the authentic, unique individual.
Well, in those two themes, Charlie sounds smaller. He sounds lighter, nimbler, cleverer. And what I also see, the tempo is not identical, but similar. The meter's different, and I think. And the fact that they're both on piano, it's just very interesting. It's like you've got the same town, but very different characters.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
What I love about it is Tom, as he said, he doesn't compete. And what we're seeing, don't forget, Charlie is a comedian. And what we're seeing there, we see the pawnbroker wringing his hands back and forth. And then Charlie walks, we see him from behind. He walks across the street, and he steps on the curb. And Chaplin finds a gag about stepping on a curb. Now, usually the only gag a comedian would think of for step would be trip. Charlie doesn't trip. What he does is he lifts himself. He takes his hand and grabs the seat of his pants, and he lifts himself up on the curb. And so he's making a joke literally about gravity. Charlie Chaplin found jokes about everything you see on the film. The things we do that we don't think about. Walking becomes funny. Lighting a cigarette becomes funny. Turning a corner. Tipping his hat.
Dusting. Becomes funny.
Everything becomes funny because of what he's doing, and that's why his films, like Tom's music, transcend language.
If you're just joining us, that was the voice of Dan Kamen, and playing the piano is Tom Roberts, and together they are just two gems from Pittsburgh. You're listening to the Saturday Light Brigade live. We've got about 5 minutes left together. They have a show coming up in Zelianopel at the Strand Theater, which is going to be celebrating, first, you know, we should mention 100 years of the Strand Theater as well.
Yeah.
Is being celebrated.
Beautiful old movie theater.
Yeah, and that was made to just be terrific. And it's also Chaplin's 125th anniversary, right?
Of his birth.
Of his birth. And then it's the 100th anniversary of the Tramp character. So he was 25 when he came up with that.
Exactly. He had hired right off the stage to make movies, and he figured, you know, that was lowbrow stuff to do. He figured he'd do it for a year and get well, better known, and return to the stage. And something happened that nobody could have expected, which was by the end of a year, he had become the biggest star in the movie world, and he was hired the following year for 10 times more money, and the following year after that for 10 times more money after that, to the point where he was making $10,000 a week, which was unprecedented.
Was he reclusive, or, I mean, did he like being out in the public? He just strikes me as somebody that would be kind of cerebral and
he was shy, and, you know, he had to deal with the fact that within a year he had become literally the most popular man on the world and the best. You know, his character had become literally the best-known character who had ever been, the best-known fictional character in history.
Wow.
Because of the reach of movies.
And because of there was no language barrier as
absolutely.
A result as well.
With his films especially. You look at some silent films, and they look like sound movies, and they should have had. You look at Chaplin's, and you never yeah. feel, oh, I wish I could hear what they were saying, because he found there's nothing you could add for the gag about pulling himself by the seat of his pants onto the curb or any of Chaplin's gags. He found the language of the primal language of movement. And I want to say one thing, because I've never said it before, but I've just been thinking about it. We've been hearing so much about the 1%. One of the things that makes Chaplin's films so viable is he came up with this costume where he's wearing a bum's clothes. He's wearing ragged clothes, misfit clothes, big pants, a short, small jacket, but they're rich person's clothes. So in his character, he embodied the tension between the 1%, the haves, and the have-not. He's always on the outside looking in, and everybody all over the world got it then, and we get it now. His films were always about something very real and very vital to people.
And he is everyone. He is capable of becoming anyone and anything as the situation calls for.
Because he's an imposter. He's on the outside. The only way he fits in is by faking it.
And he's
watch
also
him fake it, like we all
not,
do.
And he's not only an imposter, but he's perhaps maybe the only true genuine in any of these films. Everyone else is kind of in many ways, they're a caricature. They're a stereotype of a type. And he is none of them, and yet he is all of them. He is the many and the one. Hey, that was good.
Well, Charlie Chaplin has inspired artists, writers, thinkers. He was intimates with Picasso. Nijinsky came to his studio, the most famous dancer of the 20th century, came to his studio and says, "You are a dancer." And was he stopped a performance because Chaplin came to visit him in his dressing room. And, you know, Chaplin's looking at his watch because the audience is waiting as, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a half hour goes. But Nijinsky couldn't let him go because he recognized that a kindred spirit. They were both geniuses of movement who could transform human experience into kinetic action, and that's why these films have been funny for 100 years and will be funny 500 years from now.
Dan, does it never, you know, I kind of had prejudice, but it never occurred to me that your book probably talks as much about the underpinnings in life. I'd really like to read your book now. It's more than a guide for people that want to understand the movements. There's a lot more behind it, I'm guessing.
Well, as you know, like our discussion, it's just inspirational. Like any great art, you know, you don't. The Beatles haven't gotten old. You know, we still listen to them, and they still evoke these great emotions in us. And you know, and Shakespeare and Chaplin, he's in that class.
And we are down to our last 15 seconds.
No,
Ricky just reminded me. So February 21st and 23rd, Strand Theater, Zeelian Opal. We'll look for you next week. Tom Roberts, thank you.
Thank you. Shall I play us out?
You can. Join us next week.